Hey everyone, welcome to More Than Meets These Guys. This is a special interview edition of the show where we are continuing to talk to more people who worked on Transformers and G.I. Joe during this, those times in the 80s. And being that this is the 40th anniversary of Transformers, I wanted to kind of bring forth some of the most knowledgeable people on the subject, whether they remember everything or not. So everyone, welcome Buzz Dixon.
Buzz, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I've been following you a long time on Facebook because honestly, you're hilarious. The memes and the out of context things, some of my favorite Facebook feed stuff.
Oh yeah, it's good stuff.
But I actually kind of want to jump right into it. How in the world did you get connected with G.I. Joe and the Transformers back then?
Well, it's actually a little bit of an involved story. I was working at Ruby Spears Productions, and I got to know Flint Dilley. I got to know Steve Gerber, several other people who worked on the show. I might have even met Mike Hill at that point. But while I was working at Ruby Spears, I had always been telling Joe, in fact, anybody I worked for, that they really ought to develop a giant robot show, because I knew the giant robot shows were popular in Japan, and it would only be a matter of time until somebody figured out the way to get them to the U.S. And we were called in for a writer's meeting, and the guys from Hasbro were there, and they had a suitcase that they opened up, and it was filled with Transformer toys from Japan. They had bought the license on all of these toys, and they were going to mix and match three or four different licenses together to form the Transformer characters. One of the things, to save themselves about 25, 30 cents on each unit, they were going to leave out the pilot figures, and they would make the robots completely autonomous, which turned out to be a very smart move, I think, because it gave it's they didn't they were no longer vehicles, they were now characters, and it gave them a more immediate impact to the market. But in any case, they were showing this stuff to Joe, and I'm sitting there just like this, you know, trying to hold myself in. And when they left, I told Joe, I said, you have absolutely got to get involved in this. This is going to be huge. It's going to be big. I said, trust me on this one, Joe. Just whatever it takes, get involved in it. And Joe goes, nah, I got a better idea. We're going to do a show about a teenage boy who turns into a car, you know?
Oh,
and
no.
He created the Turbo Team.
Yeah.
So a short while after that, I left Ruby Spears Studios, and I was freelancing. I had done an episode of Dungeons and Dragons. I did a few other shows here and there. And Steve landed a job at Sunbow, story editing the G.I. Joe series. And I called Steve up and I said, you know, can I come in and pitch some story ideas to you? And he said, well, you know, we're full up on writers right now, and maybe for the second season. He said, but you were in the Army for 6 years. Could you do me a favor and look at some of these scripts and just give me some feedback military-wise? So I agreed to do that, and I looked at him, and we had writers who didn't actually understand how military units work and how they function. We had, you know, like sergeants giving orders to colonels, and you know, the infamous jets swooping down and slicing tanks in half with their wingtips. And I basically just said, well, you know, this is not the way these things work. And I gave them a, you know, just corrected the most egregious mistakes. And he contacted Sunbow and said, you know, Buzz is really knowledgeable on this stuff. Can we bring him in as a technical advisor? And they said, well, we don't have any money in the budget for a technical advisor, but we can squeeze one more writer in. So they opened up a slot for me. I wrote on a freelance basis. I wrote Haul Down the Heavens. That was my first G.I. Joe script. And 20 Questions was the next one, even though 20 Questions was aired before Haul Down the Heavens. One of the things you've got to understand television animation for the networks was so restrictive at that time. And to be able to do G.I. Joe, a combat-oriented animated show where people actually got to throw punches and, have fights and explosions and shoot guns and stuff like that, it was immensely liberating. And virtually everybody, their first script was just balls to the walls, blow everything up. I mean, just complete, everything we weren't allowed to do. And then once we caught our breath, the next one was, do we have to do this every time? Can we do something different? And so Sunbow kind of wisely recognized that, and they began moving the earlier scripts further back in the release order so that it wouldn't have been clogged with just a bunch of I won't say mindless, but action over character type stories early on. And I think that was what made the show work so well, was that we did focus more on the characters. We gave you plenty of action, but we focused on the characters. In any case, I very quickly went from just being a staff writer to being an unofficial story editor, assistant story editor, then officially recognized as a story editor. And then in the second season, I did all the story editing for the second season. So that was my progress on G.I. Joe.
Nice. Jumping over to Transformers, we me and my usual co-host Ed recently did a review of The God's Gambit, which was one of my favorite episodes from years and years. I always remember that one because honestly, it really speaks to higher brow sci-fi, and it kind of comes down to questioning, religion, and it's kind of that's cutting edge for children's TV. So that was interesting to see that. But were there any censorship hurdles you had when you were faced with that episode? And were there any parts of the script you had to redo?
I don't recall any hurdles. I know Sunbow basically said, "Now you're not going to be attacking religion." And I said, "Oh, no. This is attacking charlatans who use religion. I'm going to be very careful about that." Because I knew they would be, I mean, I'm a Christian myself, and I was what prompted me to write the script was I was just so irritated at these televangelists who go out there and just milk people for money, and they lie to them, and I mean, I was in a really foul mood about some of these clowns at that point.
Good reason.
And as Rod Serling figured out with the Twilight Zone, if you make something fantastic, you can talk about real things, but when you've put it into a fantastic setting, you're not going to get the criticism as if you had done it in real life. I mean, it was, doing a story about televangelists on Earth, misleading people, that would have been really difficult. Setting it on Titan with aliens and a pagan type, religious system that I could get away with.
Nice.
It
It's
had
very
almost like a Star Trek original series feel to it.
well, yeah, thank you. I was a fan of Star Trek. I mean, I'm not as big a fan as a lot of people, but I did enjoy the original Star Trek, and I wanted to get that kind of sensibility into it.
Yeah, and speaking of God Gambit, one of your big I guess people say your claim to fame on the second season of Transformers is you kind of put Omega Supreme's speech pattern at that you said it as far as the story bible goes. What was the impetus for that? And I mean, we always laugh because we also just did The Secret of Omega Supreme recently, and he said to Optimus Prime, like, well, now for this one time I'll talk to you like I used to talk. So it's a choice he made, which cracks me up. But yeah, what was the story with that speech pattern? Okay.
I mean, honest to goodness, you're sitting there and you're trying to differentiate one character from another in any way that you can. You've got the advantage that they all look somewhat different. They're different colors, different designs, and things like that. But you also want to differentiate the speech patterns. And Honest to God, I haven't the faintest idea what was going through my head. All I knew was I needed to get the script done, you know, by a certain date. The analogy I give people is you got to imagine you're at a train station and there's a freight train going by very slowly, but it's not stopping. And every day an open boxcar passes by you and you've got to throw something in there. And if what you throw in is good, all the better, but something's got to go in. And I honestly could not tell you at this point what I was thinking when I did that.
Yeah, according to the internet, that was one of the things you kind of cemented the speech pattern, but it may have just been a thing at the time. Giant robot guy talks slowly and doesn't use complete grammar as he talks. It seemed more robotic, less, I guess, emotional.
He was being used, as I recall, more as a mode of transportation in that episode, if I think. And yeah, so to me, and also he was like depleted of energy as well. Mm-hmm. So it was more of a the specific circumstances, and they just may have liked that. I mean, I am not conversant enough on Transformers to tell you whether I was the first person to use the character to any great degree or not. I was doing G.I. Joe, and as I said, every day, both G.I. Joe and Transformers, something had to be in the boxcar. Mm-hmm. And on more than one occasion, they'd come to me and say, you know, we need a script by Friday. And okay, fine. And, you know, we'd hash something out, and I'd get to work on it. I would be story editing during the day at the office, and at night I'd go home and I'd be up until like 1 or 2 in the morning working on stuff. The three Transformers that I did, I think 2 by myself and 1 with Flint. Well, I'll take that back. The three that I'm credited on were all cases of, we need to get something in the system really fast. You know, what can you do? In the case with Flint, he had, I'm not being literal here, but he had roughly half the idea and he couldn't make it gel. And I suggested the big game hunter aspect of it and the Lord Chumley character.
Oh, Prime Target.
Yeah, Prime Target. That fitted all together and we were able to complete it pretty quickly. There were, however, several times, not only for G.I. Joe where I was story editing, but, you know, someone would come in and say, this has got to go out today. Act 3 is a mess. Can you fix it? And yeah, sure. Fix it. Get it out of the system. My name never goes on it. As a story editor, it's anathema to me to put my name on somebody else's script. With Flint, it was an actual collaboration from the very beginning. But a lot of the other things that I did, never put my name on.
Okay. Well, actually, it's kind of funny you brought up Prime Target. So you say that a lot of these episodes, you had to like throw a package in each passing freight car, but you were able to bring in some elements that really gelled the some of the Sunbow universe together. And that that element is a very conspicuous looking, almost looks like Geraldo Rivera and Hector Ramirez. Yeah, I figured as much. So he's in Prime Target, but he's also in Jim and he's in G.I. Joe, which it's one of those things.
And in Humanoids.
Oh, yeah. And Humanoids too.
Cult of Darkness.
Yep. And that was, honestly, Boo is a very big fan of Inhumanoids.
Yeah.
So that'll be great to talk about as well. But it was one of those things where we had something that basically made the universe, I guess, gel as one. It was, you know, whatever weak or strong link it was, it's something that stuck out to me and we always kind of joke about.
Well, it's interesting how that came about because as much as I dislike religious charlatans, I dislike journalistic charlatans. And Rivera had done a 2-hour expose. This was during the Satanic Panic. And I don't know how many of your viewers are old enough to remember this, but in the 80s, there was literally a witchcraft Satanism panic that swept the country.
I remember that.
The McMartin School case, other cases. There were people going to jail for lengthy periods of time on completely bogus, false accusations that they were, committing all kinds of crimes against children and stuff like that. And it was all bogus. And Rivera had a 2-hour special on, the Satanism crisis or whatever. And he had on the show a woman who he claimed had been the victim of some satanic cult. And it was so clearly obvious this poor woman had some kind of mental condition. And he was exploiting this woman who was, I have a great deal of pity and empathy for her because, she's not dealing with the full deck, so to speak. And it just irritated me no end. So when I was pitching my second G.I. Joe script, I thought, well, it would be kind of funny if Geraldo Rivera was trying to do an expose on G.I. Joe and he ends up validating him. And, obviously we couldn't use Geraldo Rivera, so I came up with Hector Ramirez, Hector from hectoring people, irritating them.
Yes.
Come up with Hector Ramirez, and this will help you understand things. Whenever you create a character for a show, the legal department has to sign off on the likeness and the name. And when we did this, everybody understood, yeah, we're poking fun at Geraldo Rivera, but we're not actually calling him Geraldo Rivera. They cleared the name Hector Ramirez. If there had been somebody who was actually a newscaster at some, UHF station somewhere out in New Mexico, who was Hector Ramirez, we wouldn't have been able to use the name. We could get away with it because there was nobody that they could find in journalism with that name. So they approved the name. They cast the voice and we did the show. It was a lot of fun. I didn't think about using him again until I did The Traitor. And The Traitor was originally supposed to be a half-hour episode. It just grew to the point where I was going to have to turn it into a two-parter. Sunbow approved, so they let me do it as a two-part episode. And I thought, instead of doing the stereotypical in our last episode recap, why not have Hector come back on his TV show, 20 Questions, and just do it as a news recap? And, we've got the character's likeness approved, the name is approved, the role is cast. We're going to save ourselves a lot of time. So Sunbow goes, yeah, okay, fine. We do that, and we stick Hector in as the bridging segment between the two halves. Well, at that point, other people began to realize, if I ever need to do a info dump, Hector Ramirez is the guy to do it because his job is to look in the camera and tell you something. And then you can just boot him out of the story and never have to worry about him again. So Hector started popping up all over the place whenever people needed an info dump. It was like, yeah, drag Hector in, have him look at the camera, tell you something, and then out he goes.
Perfect. Yeah, it was one of the weird little links to all three of those shows, which is great. It once again sets in the same universe.
Or yeah, and he's like the glue that holds the Sunbow universe together.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you something, and this is a disappointment. I had two chances to bring the little ponies into the Sunbow universe, and in one case, Sunbow turned me down, and in the second case, I came up with the idea too late. The first case was for the My Little Pony movie. They asked me to look at the script and give them feedback, and my feedback consisted mainly of suggesting places where songs could go. But I also said we ought to have a scene where one of the ponies is out looking for help, flying around looking for help. And I said we ought to have them go to Transformers headquarters and try to get Optimus Prime to help. And then have them fly over to G.I. Joe headquarters. And I said we would have Shipwreck sitting in the back of the barracks drinking a beer, and this little flying pony comes up, and they said, no, we're not doing that. And then for Once Upon a Joe, I have him telling a fairy tale to these orphans, but they're chibi characters in the fairy tale. They're not, actual G.I. Joe characters. And that was, that was kind of a silly one-off type thing. And after the script had been approved and it went over to Marvel to be storyboarded, it suddenly hit me, make them ponies. Make all the characters ponies. And so I called storyboard department and said, can we possibly change the character designs, make them ponies? And they said, nah, we're too far into it. So, that one I take the blame for. I should have thought of that idea earlier, and then everything would have been tied together in one nice package.
Some disparate elements all together. So, honestly, the things that hangs over season three of Transformers is switching to ACOM, which was them fledgling ACOM. They've done a lot now. They've come a long way. But one of the really neatest ideas for an episode, but is often maligned because of the animation, is Carnage in C Minor. Once again, feels very much like a Star Trek, the original series episode. Did you have a lot of instances where maybe something was really, I guess, I don't know if tarnish is the right word, but maybe hamstrung because of using fledgling animation?
I don't think that was the problem. Probably entirely in the script, I'll be honest. What it happened? I mean, there's another one I can give you the origin of. The origin to that goes all the way back to Filmation Studios, where I started working in 1978. Lou Scheimer would, ask for people to develop ideas, and I came up with an idea for a musical superhero that got his powers through music. And Lou was basically, yeah, I'm not paying for musicians, so that idea went. But it stuck around in the back of my head, and again, it was one of those circumstances. We need a script by a certain date, and I said, well, how about a musical? And they go, yeah, fine, whatever, just get it done. So anything that wasn't up to snuff, I take full blame for it. It was the script. It wasn't the company.
Well, a lot of the script itself holds up pretty well. It's the, I guess they didn't get the proper scaling for the characters, so everybody's out of scale in that episode.
Yeah, that happens. I mean, you've got these weird things. One of the things that always amuses me when I watch some of the older episodes is they could never keep Sergeant Slaughter's hat on model. And it's like he's, you can just imagine him. He's like a quick change artist, just changing hats all the time. And, how difficult is it? But apparently very difficult. We would occasionally get, you rarely get animated mistakes. Every now and then something, odd happens, like they get the orientation of a staircase wrong, and the character is going down the stairs at like a 45 degree angle to the way they should be. You get weird little things like that. You get problems with color. You get they just animate something badly and they have to go back and redo it. Usually this stuff is caught in the storyboard stage. I've given this story before. I was writing a script where I had three of the dreadnoughts arguing with one another on an airstrip. And two of them were arguing and the third one was listening in. I think it was Buzzer that was listening in. And then Buzzer joins the argument, and in the script, I just type Buzzer sticks his oar in the water, meaning he joins the argument. We get the storyboards back, and all of a sudden there's a creek running right across the airstrip and he's holding an oar. And I'm like, no, that was a metaphor, guys. Don't take it literally.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's good stuff.
Yeah, Bill, I think you had some questions in form about the G.I. Joe movie, and so actually the show as well.
Yes. I was curious about, because I know originally you were planning the most dangerous man in the world. And I guess that got sidelined when they brought in Serpentor and Cobra Law. And I was wondering, like, how did that all come about and how would it have been different with the most dangerous man in the world?
Cobra Law is what sank it. If it had been just Serpentor, we could have still used the idea. That came about because Larry Hama was doing the comic and we were doing the animated show. And even though we never discussed this between ourselves, Larry never looked at the show while he was doing the comic, and we never, read the comic closely while we were doing the show. We recognize there are two different mediums, two different audiences. There's a lot of overlap, but the TV audience is different from the comic book audience. And we recognize it would be an exercise in futility to try to sync these things up. So I know Larry had come up with an origin for Cobra in the comics, and I thought, well, I'd like to do something different from that. So I had pitched the idea to Sunbow, and I said, basically, we've got a Friedrich Nietzsche, Karl Marx of Cobra, who has been held prisoner by Cobra all this time because basically Cobra Commander has screwed up the philosophy that's supposed to be behind Cobra. And when he escapes, Cobra ceases all worldwide operations to look for this guy. And the Joes have no idea who he is. They only know if Cobra wants him, we got to get him first. The Joes get him and then find out he is just this colossal pain in the ass. And in the end, he escapes the Joes. And the Joes go, you know what? Let him go. He's out there causing trouble for Cobra. That's fine by us. And it was supposed to be just a one-of episode that would have alluded to the origin of Cobra. And Hasbro approved it, and they said, go to script. They said, just make sure there's a place in the script for the Cobra Emperor. I said, the Cobra who? And they said, the Cobra Emperor. And I said, well, who's the Cobra Emperor? And they said, well, he's the leader of Cobra. And I said, no, he's not. So we've just done a whole season where Cobra Commander is the commander in chief. If you had told us, drop hints, there's somebody above him, we could have done that, and then we could have introduced the character. But we can't spring a character unannounced, who outranks Cobra Commander. I mean, it was not like G.I. Joe, where if a general shows up, people go, well, yeah, the military has a lot of generals. There would absolutely be a general we've never seen before who, supervises G.I. Joe. So they said, oh, yeah, well, come up with some ideas on how to introduce the character. And I tell young writers, if anyone ever asks you to come up with a couple of ideas, don't. Come up with the idea you want to do and present that. Because if they could come up with ideas, they wouldn't be asking you to develop any. So I came up with two ideas, one where they create Serpentor using the DNA of all the great military leaders of the past, and the other where there is a super secret organization behind Cobra. And they're ticked off that Cobra Commander has screwed things up and they send a replacement. So I send these ideas in, and Hasbro contacts me and said, great, do it. And I said, do which one? And they said, both of them. So Arise, Serpentor, Arise became the opener miniseries for season two.
Yes.
Yeah, season two. And the Cobra Law became the G.I. Joe, the movie. By having, we could explain away creating Serpentor using DNA and still have the most dangerous man in the world, the philosopher, as the guy who started Cobra, and now Cobra creates a brand new leader. We could have done that, but we couldn't do it with a super secret, you know, civilization, you know, funding Cobra from, you know, behind the scenes. So that pretty much torpedoed the idea. Many years later, when Amazon had their, it was Kindle something, Kindle Worlds. They had their Kindle Worlds fanfic project going. And basically there was about a couple of dozen franchises, fiction franchises that you could write stories for. They would be published by Amazon and you would get royalties off of them. As people liked them and read them, you would get paid for them. So it was basically a way for some people who were writing fan fiction to write fan fiction and get paid. So I figured, well, you know what? I've always wanted to tell this story. This is the time to do it. And I wrote a short novel called The Most Dangerous Man in the World. It was up for about like maybe 6 months, and then they canceled the Kindle Worlds program. And so everybody's work reverted back to them, but you can't use it anymore because it's owned by somebody else. So it's not been seen since then. I have told people, you know, publishers, if you're interested in doing this, if you've got the G.I. Joe license, you know, give me a call. I'll be happy to work something out, but nobody's expressed any interest in it.
It's too bad.
No.
Yeah, and well, considering, you know, what Skybound's doing lately, they're really leaning into a lot of your work for, you know, their new comic. They've got the license now, so yes. You may want to talk to them about that.
I have no connections over there. Anybody who knows anybody over there, tell them, you know, Buzz said give him a call. You know, I'm not hard to find.
Yeah, because that would be awesome. Because they really are leaning a lot into the Sunbow world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, they're leaning a lot into the idea of Cobra Commander being a scientist and, you know, the idea of Cobra Law, but not so grandiose as it was in the movie, but more, you know, I guess low key, very secret, and where, you know, kind of he got his backing in to start. So, yeah, that would be actually play perfect into that. So, okay, Skybound, I don't know if you're watching this, give him a call. All right, Boo, you had some other things about one of the episodes there. It's my favorite with Sins of Our Fathers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's a really cool one. With that one, which you wrote that one as well, correct? Where they summon the creature from Destro's Well. There's like a monster in the bottom of Destro's Well and they summon him up.
I know the episode you're talking about. Did I write that one? I mean, I'm not going to
tell
you. Yeah, I
believe that one. Yeah, that one's credited to you.
Okay, I'll take your word on it. I mean, I gotta explain. I have worked on so many different projects and things. I apparently story edited the Teen Wolf animated show, and I saw this and I said, this has got to be a mistake. I have no memory of this. And my wife says, no, you were the story editor, all right. And I'm going, you know, it didn't adhere.
Right.
And I'm not saying that is a bad reflection on the producers or anything else. For whatever reason, you know, it just in one ear and out the other. So.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Well, I just had a question about H.P. Lovecraft's influence on a lot of the Sunbow stories, because I know that one seemed very Lovecraftian with the creature in the well and. Yeah. There were several Transformers episodes too, and of course, Inhumanoids was very Lovecraftian. So I was just curious, was there a culture of like Lovecraft fandom at Sunbow, or
not Lovecraft fandom specifically, but there was Steve, Flint, myself, almost everybody were fans of old pulp fiction, and we loved the old pulp sci-fi, fantasy, horror, adventure stories, crime stories. And we delved into that quite a bit. We were certainly conversant. We knew who Lovecraft was. We knew about the Thulu mythos. We didn't at the time realize just, how virulent his racial views were, because, people, there's the excuse, well, it was the times. For some things you can give that excuse. He went out of his way. And a lot of it was just, and it's not just Pulp Fiction. I mean, Walt Whitman turned out to be a huge racist, and he's like this beloved American poet, but his executor just kept all the really rabid stuff away from public view, protected his reputation. And so you've got this vision of Walt Whitman as this proto-hippie out there, and you think of him as peace and love and embracing everybody. And no, he was a very racist person, even for the time. With Lovecraft, the idea of ancient gods, of somebody, ruling this earth or this universe before we got here and waiting their opportunity to come back. That's clearly something that, I mean, within humanoids in particular, but even with G.I. Joe and Transformers, that's a great story prompt idea. You can get something out of that. So we were not specifically Lovecraft fans, but we all knew who Lovecraft was, and we all saw the opportunity to use his ideas.
It's kind of hard to avoid his influence around that time, because there was a lot of it, even in like horror movies. They were
Oh
borrowing a lot from Necronomicon, Evil Dead, and all that.
Though I can only imagine what Lovecraft's reaction would have been if he had ever seen the Reanimator movie. I mean, it would have blown his mind, I'm sure.
But then again, with him, there's no telling. He may have thought it was the best thing he could have anyone could have done for one of the stories. There's no telling. I mean, honestly, there's a lot of those writers from that time are kind of problematic. Like
I'm
how?
gonna say something, and this reflects badly on me. I had friends who were writers who went to see it, and they came back and they said, we were watching the movie, and when it got to the point where the headless corpse is holding the head in its hands and is using it to have his way with the victim, they said, we all thought of you, Buzz.
That's a scene everyone, even if you haven't seen it, you've heard of that scene. So yeah, we all get that. Yeah, I
It's
mean
one of those scenes. It's like the giant maggot scene in Forbidden World. I think no, Galaxy of Terror, I think. Yeah, Galaxy of Terror. That was the smart Roger Corman Alien ripoff. Forbidden World is the dumb one. They're both fun, but for different reasons. Yeah, Galaxy of Terror, they have a somewhat similar scene where this, the premise is this planet will turn your fears against you, and this giant maggot evolves and it assaults one of the crew members. And it's one of those things that you look at it and it is so far over the top, it stops being offensive. It is so ridiculous. It is so extreme. And I'm sure there may be people who are offended by it. I'm not saying you're wrong, but for a lot of people, you're looking at it and it is just so far gone, you can't take it seriously. You can't. It just, yeah. I mean, and that was the way it was with Reanimator. It's
And
the way it was with the Galaxy of Terror.
I mean that's what actually one of these strangely how should I put this charming things about Roger Corman. You could make horrible so ridiculous that it wasn't horrible anymore, just almost became a little silly.
Fun,
No. I
So,
don't think Roger had much of a sense of humor. I think when the humor ended up in his films, for the most part, if it was somebody else directing it, he wasn't aware of the humor. I know he made like Little Shop of Horrors and what's the one where Dick Miller is playing the artist who's the beatnik artist.
Oh, Bucket of Blood.
Bucket of Blood, yeah.
Yeah.
But in both of those cases, it was, you know, we're making fun of a genre that already exists. Oh, and the what was a crazy one that he did? The one where the monster is, it's the people fleeing the Cuban Revolution, and there's the sea monster that comes up, and it's like a really dumb sea monster. Oh, man. The thing that's interesting about that one is that it was it and The Last Woman on Earth were both written by Robert Towne, who wrote Chinatown and went on to become a major
Oh, wow.
director. And this was like Towne's one of his first gigs. And Corman flew him down to Puerto Rico, where they shot both of these movies back to back. And they didn't have scripts for either one. He was just like, yeah, just start writing and we'll start shooting the movies as we go along. And you can see this in Last Woman on Earth, which is, it's not a great movie, but I mean, it's an adequate, very low budget, you know, last people on Earth movie. But there's a scene in it where they see something and say, oh my God, how horrible. Ooh, yeah. Well, we got to come back and take care of that. And obviously they were going to come back and have something horrible that they would encounter, and they never got around to doing it. And the second one, I'm trying to remember what the name, something Haunted Sea, Monster from the Haunted Sea, Creature from the Haunted Sea, something like that. Let me see what I can find here. We've got the technology, as they say. Oh, but anyway,
yeah,
that one
was sea.
Just tongue-in-cheek all the way through. It was a parody of Key Largo.
Oh, wow.
And the actor playing the captain of the boat, he's doing a Humphrey Bogart impersonation all the way through. There's another character who only speaks in animal sound effects. It is just, it's whacked-out comedy. And it works because I don't think Corman had a sense of humor. I mean, Corman is just shooting the stuff straight, and you're looking at it and you're going, this is ridiculous. If he had had a sense of humor, he would have tried to make it funny, and it wouldn't have connected, because it works as like an airplane movie where everything is done straight faced. I'm gonna see that.
Is it The Haunted Sea? I think
The Haunted Sea, I think. James Brolin in that one?
No. That's a much later movie.
Okay.
This one would be Creature from the Haunted Sea, I think. Let's see.
That's
oh yeah, yeah. There's from 61.
Yeah, 61. Yeah. That was it. Creature from the Haunted Sea.
That's it. Yeah.
And if you look at it, it looks like the monster looks like a Muppet. I'm not exaggerating. Great big ping pong eyeballs, you know. I mean,
oh,
it's
just
ridiculous. But Corman would put ridiculous things in his movie, not realizing they're ridiculous. I mean, he was a nice guy. I met him once, and you know, very charming, very erudite. But I really don't think he had a sense of humor. He, you know, he hired Paul Bartel to direct Death Race 2000.
Mm-hmm.
He hated Bartel's version because Bartel did this thing tongue in cheek all the way through, and Corman, no, it's got to be real. It's got to be actual car chases and stuff. And he hated what Bartel did, but the movie was successful enough. They did a follow up called Death Sport. And for Death Sport, you know, Corman had it done his way, no humor, no jokes, nothing like that. And, you know, Death Sport is just, eh.
Yeah, I actually never heard of that one. Death
Yeah.
Race 2000, yeah.
David Carradine's in it, and they're riding motorcycles. So.
Oh, okay, yeah.
All right, excellent. I love the Corman tangent. You know, going back to something, like a lot of those writers in that period, though, are kind of problematic. you know, going back to Edgar Allan Poe. But I always like to tell people that Lovecraft was a spoiled mama's boy who didn't really wasn't very socially adept. So he wrote a lot of stories. You know, and Howard, you know, his Conan novels, they were pen pals. There's a very problematic things in the stories, but also in their personal lives.
Howard was if you talk about mama's boys, Howard was really the mama's boy. He was
there's a
very
great
unhealthy relationship with his mother. And I do not mean that in a sexual sense. I mean just in being dependent on her. Oddly enough, they can't document Howard ever going more than 40 miles from his home, with the exception, I think, they know one time he went to New Orleans, and that's about it. But Howard stayed at home almost all his entire life. Lovecraft, you think, would be the recluse. He actually traveled quite a bit. And here's the other thing. I did a project where I had to research both of their lives. Of the two, who do you think was the crack marksman?
I would assume Howard.
Oh, right. You think Howard.
Howard was a terrible shot. Lovecraft was an expert marksman with a pistol. He used to go to the Providence junkyard, garbage yard, whatever you called it, garbage pit. He'd go there and he'd shoot rats. And he was like an expert marksman. And Howard was just, everybody in town knew him to be a terrible shot.
There's a great movie actually. It came out, I think, around mid 90s, called The Whole Wide World. That was Vincent
Yes.
D'Onofrio playing Howard. Kind of gives you an idea of the kind of person he was. And it's very, very lightly touched on that he and Lovecraft, you know, talked to each other a lot. But it's kind of an interesting look at how his mind may have worked.
Yeah.
Obviously dramatized.
Yeah, that was a project that I had going briefly at Eclipse Comics, and then Eclipse Comics essentially imploded, and I never followed up on it because afterwards, as more and more stuff started coming out about Lovecraft, I figured, you know, I just don't need to be involved in this.
I'll let that
But
one go.
I had come up with a project where somebody believing Lovecraft had access to some, you know, alien entity is trying to get him, you know, trying to kidnap him so that he can use him to contact that entity. And Lovecraft is, you know, on the run. He's afraid for his life, and he comes to Texas hoping that Howard can help him. And he arrives just as Howard is about to kill himself, you know. And Howard's father convinces Lovecraft, the only thing that'll keep my son alive is if he thinks he's helping you. You know, the father doesn't believe any of this crap, but he says, you just get him away from Texas, get him roaming around the country, just let this burn out of him. And then, you know, when it's done, you can bring him back. Mm-hmm. And it of course turns out to be real, but it was going to be this big epic, you know, pulp adventure with a, you know, horrific ending at it. But as I said, Eclipse basically imploded, and you know, I never followed up with the project because the more I started learning about Lovecraft, the less I wanted to be involved in anything.
Right.
Like that.
Yeah. A bit problematic.
Yeah.
So, you mentioned the Satanic Panic. You know, we grew up in a time where the Satanic Panic hit when we were growing up. I mean, my mother found out I played the old Redbox Dungeons and Dragons at a friend's house across the street when I was young, and she forbade me from doing that ever again because Satanic Panic. And I know there's been, you know, incarcerations. I followed the story of the West Memphis Three, things like that. I mean, the Satanic Panic was very prescient in that period of time, and people who are younger than myself and Boo may not realize how, you know, prevalent it was. And we grew up in the, you know, the South. And so, I mean, there were shows, the idea of the Satanic Panic shows up in a lot of the episodes. You know, you're like Sins of Our Fathers, you know, Cult Slither, and then Humanoids, the Cult of Darkness. I mean, were you just writing because it was such a prevalent thing at the time in
Oh
the
yeah. The McMartin case was going on, and for those who may not be familiar with the McMartin case, McMartin Preschool was it was basically a daycare center, but they had kindergarten classes, and the adult son of the woman who ran the McMartin school, the initial complaint against him was that he wore shorts that exposed himself. And when you read that complaint, you go, okay, I can see that happening. I can see the guy, doesn't think, and he puts on shorts that are too short, and somebody catches a glimpse. I see raking him over the coals for that. I could even see his, the school saying, yeah, let's let you go work somewhere else because, we can't have you around the kids. But it mushroomed from that. Years later, it turned out that it was promoted by a real estate agent who wanted to get his hands on the McMartin property. And he thought that by driving them into bankruptcy, he could get his hands on the property for development. Anyway, it mushroomed from one teacher, possibly deliberately, possibly inadvertently, exposing himself in a small way to children being taken through underground tunnels. I mean, I'm telling you literally what the children were testifying to. Taken up in the air in hot air balloons, forced to sacrifice animals up to and including a pony, and never a shred of evidence. The children would be brought in and they would say to the children, now tell us what happened. And the children would say, nothing happened. And they would go, oh, we know something happened. Now don't be scared. And they would basically coach the children into telling things that were just so incredibly far-fetched that, once the panic was over and people actually looked at what was being testified to, people realized this is just insane that you could not conduct this kind of large-scale operation without being noticed. Somebody somewhere is going to notice you moving dozens of kids around, taking them on hot air balloons. They're going to wonder what all the, animals are going into the place are. I mean, they tried looking for these tunnels. I mean, they literally dug up the property looking for evidence of tunnels. There were no tunnels. And it's like, this should be it. I mean, this should be where you say something has happened to whatever originally happened, the investigation has taken it into a completely wrong direction. The police also bungled it because when they started the investigation, they sent letters to all the parents saying, oh, this guy has been accused of exposing himself to children. And if anything bad has happened to your kids, let us know. Come on. You've got these parents who are rightfully protective of their children, and of course, they're gonna pressure their kids. They want to know what happened, and it just mushroomed. It was happening not just in California, but it was happening. You were talking about the Memphis Three. It happened in everywhere. It happened in Washington State. It happened in Illinois. It happened in New Jersey. They even had cases where somebody would be accused of, being a satanic pedophile, and the police would just browbeat the person until they confessed. And they actually convinced a few people, for a brief period of time, I must have done this and blanked it out of my mind. It was because it was so horrible. And no, you were just brainwashed by aggressive police. And eventually the thing burned out because there was no evidence. The terrible thing is that a few real pedophiles, once they heard about the satanic panic, well, at that point, well, I'll put on a devil mask and, you know, the kid won't, nobody will believe the kid.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it had a lot of shades of like the Salem witch trials and stuff, how a lot of it turned out to just be a land grab.
Absolutely. It was absolutely just like the Salem witch trials. And the terrible thing is that a lot of these children, three, four, 5 years old at the time, had it hammered into them that something terrible had happened to them, that now as adults, they absolutely believed it happened. They created false memories in them. And I don't blame those people for believing this, because they were worked on, you know, for a long period of time. But
there's a story, I think is Michelle remembers.
Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing. You know, she
completely bogus.
Yeah.
There was a book by a writer named Mari Terry called The Ultimate Evil.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to read it as a work of fiction, wow, it is a great work of fiction, because he took literally dozens, maybe hundreds of cases around the country, and he created this elaborate conspiracy that linked them all together. The problem is that a lot of these things, a lot of these crimes ended up being solved as DNA technology got better and better. And nobody went back and said, gosh, you know, all of these things that we linked to a satanic group, turns out they were committed by about like 20, 30 different people, you know, one of a kind murders that never occurred again.
Yeah.
But you can't undo it. The book came out and it had an enormous influence on that period.
I mean, yeah, there's books like Turmoil in the Toy Box by Phil Phillips, which I had to find. I wouldn't give the any money, so I had to find it secondhand used. I had to read this thing, and it reads like you said, you know, like, how outlandish can we make this claim? And you know, are they really just innocent toys, or are there cult things? No, well, there's so much that it's funny though. I was going to bring up, not to make anything political here, that it you see shades of that with the QAnon things.
Oh yeah,
totally.
Yeah.
And it's so much easier to spread this misinformation now because of the internet and messages.
Yeah.
So it's almost like it never has gone away. It's just changed forms.
Yeah.
So
we had before I when I was working in network television, there was a guy named Thomas Radecki, who was he was out after children's animation. He hated D&D. He really hated G.I. Joe, but we couldn't have cared less. Radecki, you know, just basically led the charge against children's programming in almost every form. And the knee slapper is he eventually ended up serving, I think, like 10 years in prison for sexually assaulting one of his patients.
Oh, wow.
There so, you know, there's a saying that every accusation is a confession.
Yes.
And yes. I think there are a lot of people, I think people who are, when I say healthy, I mean in the sense of respecting other people's boundaries. I think people with a healthy set of boundaries, they may not like something, but they won't go crazy over it. They won't fabricate stuff. And they'll have lives where they don't do anything, you know, that shows they're crazy. And then you have people like Radecki who, you know, it turns out, well, the reason you hated all this was deep down inside there, you were there, you know.
Yeah.
You hated it because it was showing you something inside you.
Yeah,
exactly. Protests too much.
Yeah.
Ah, yes. So, yeah, actually, I'm going to pulls back towards the lightheartedness of 80s cartoons. Now, not that I'm not enjoying this topic, because I could talk about this all day. But so we know what happened with the death of Optimus Prime in mm-hmm. the movie and the backlash from it. Mm-hmm. And we hear that played right into Duke going into a coma. I mean, how was that broached, and how did that all come about?
We had I was not involved in the Transformers movie. I was asked to look over and make suggestions on the script for the My Little Pony movie. I scripted the Transformers, not Transformers, the G.I. Joe movie. Ron Friedman gets writer credit on that. I get story consultant credit. Mm-hmm. The facts are, and Ron and I are friends, so there's no animosity here. Don't misread anything here. Ron had a really good agent who got him a guarantee that his name would be the only name of a writer on anything he worked on. And so he got a writer's credit on Arise, Serpentor, Arise, even though he was working off my outline. And I went through and I edited it to make it closer to my vision when it was done. He wrote a script for the G.I. Joe movie that the only carryover was Nemesis Enforcer, the winged villain. Everybody liked Nemesis Enforcer, but they didn't care for the rest of the story. Hasbro sent me the script and said, we'd like you to come to New York and talk to us about this. And I read the script flying out there, because this was like really a last minute thing. And when I got to talk to them, they said, what did you think about the script? And I said, I'll be perfectly honest. I think you'd be better off starting afresh rather than try to fix it. And they said, that was pretty much our feeling too. And they said, would you like to write it? And I said, of course, I would be delighted to write it. And so that's when Cobra Law came into the picture. We had done the show without ever killing anybody. And I, whenever I wrote a script, I always tried to have somebody get hurt to show that it wasn't, just all fun and games. People could get hurt. Of course, they're healed by the next episode, but nonetheless, I would acknowledge that. And a few times I would sneak in a line where somebody would say, yeah, we suffered 17% casualties. Hasbro never realized casualties means wounded and dead. So, I was at least trying to acknowledge there was a physical price to pay for, all this stuff. So I told him, I said, look, you're planning on cycling Duke out of the product line. And I can talk about that in just a moment. You're gonna get rid of Duke from the product line. We've been doing the show 2-3 years, if you count the miniseries before the first season. You've been doing it 3 years, and you've had all this shoot 'em up stuff, and you've never killed anybody. It's a movie. Let's kill Duke. Let him die a heroic death. And they thought, well, that's a good idea. Go ahead. And I wrote this scene where Duke sacrifices himself to save his half-brother, Lieutenant Falcon. They liked it so much, they suggested to the team doing the Transformers movie, kill off Optimus Prime, because we're going to get rid of Optimus Prime too. The thing that Hasbro did not realize at the time, two things they didn't realize. One was that certain core characters you could not get rid of. The Duke, Flint, Lady J, Roadblock, Gung-Ho, they are just too vital to the story, to the concept, to ever get them out. You don't have to do every story involving them, but you can't get rid of them. Same with Optimus Prime. Optimus Prime is the hero in Transformers. You can't just work him out. The second thing is, if you're going to introduce new characters and phase old characters out, do it in the TV show. Because people will accept it in the TV show. If you're selling a movie called G.I. Joe or Transformers, the audience buying those tickets want to see the characters they are familiar with. They don't want to see a bunch of brand new characters introduced. And that was one of the things that worked against the Ponies movie, worked against Transformers, worked against G.I. Joe. We tried introducing a bunch of new characters, and we shouldn't have done that. They should have been introduced, you know, in the miniseries, and then just established characters in the movies. So the distribution deal was that Dino De Laurentiis Pictures would distribute the film. It would be matinees, and I believe I'm accurate here, but you know, if I'm wrong, then, you know, it's, you know, blame my memory. But the deal was there would be three Saturday matinee showings and two Sunday matinee showings. It was not going to be all week long at a theater. And for a kid's movie at that time, that was a pretty normal, unless you were Disney, that was a pretty normal release pattern. They did the Ponies movie first, then Transformers and G.I. Joe. The Pony movie came out, and De Laurentiis didn't deliver the prerequisite number of days. They only got two screenings on Saturday, one screening on Sunday. Same for the Transformers. And that irritated Hasbro enough to break the deal, and they never officially released G.I. Joe, the movie, at that time. It was later cut into another miniseries for the TV show, and it was released on DVD, but it never made it to the theaters. In fact, we had a sneak preview at a theater near Comic-Con that year, which was the first and only time that I think it was ever shown in a theater. And then many, many years later, the Egyptian Theater did a double feature of the Transformers movie and the G.I. Joe movie. Oh, wow. And for the first time, I got to see it in an audience that was there to enjoy the movie, that had come wanting to see it. And it enabled me to make my peace with the movie. Let's just put it that way. When I heard the audience reacting the way I hoped an audience would react, I realized, okay, for whatever specific irritations I have with the movie, it clearly pleased a lot of people, and you know, I'm happy for that, and so I'm happy for the movie now. But that was they told him to kill off Optimus Prime. They did. Here's the other thing. My Little Pony movie, absolutely parents have to bring the kids, okay? Transformer movie, a lot of the audience was 10 years of age or younger. And in most of those cases, parents are going to be bringing the kids. G.I. Joe, the target audience was 12 and over. And so 12-year-olds, they're mentally prepared to accept the fact in combat somebody can get killed. And if we had killed Duke in the movie, they would have been heartbroken, they would have been upset, but they would have recognized this is what happens in war. You've got these 9-year-olds watching the Transformers movie. The parents who are with them, they're like, it's like an acid flashback in High Martian. They have absolutely no idea what's going on. It's just this riot of color and noise and music, and they have no idea what's going on. And then all of a sudden, all the children in the audience are screaming and crying, and the parents are going, what happened? What? And you know, the parents really didn't like being put through that. We had one kid, I think he was in Pennsylvania, who locked himself in a closet because he was so distraught over Optimus Prime dying.
Yeah, Mike.
Yes, he said, all right, we can't kill Duke. And I said, you can kill Duke. Different audience, different type of story. I mean, it's, you can do this. But they insisted. And in the long run, probably best, because if they had killed Duke off, then he wouldn't have been in the product line anymore. And a lot of people who were fans of Duke might have drifted away from the franchise. So
yeah, anyway, we encounter a lot of fans that are grown now, but they gave up after Transformers the movie. Like season 3 and 4, they just let it go as kids because of Optimus Prime's death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a lesson that Hasbro learned the hard way, and anybody who's thinking of doing a movie based on a TV show, don't kill your star.
Oh, now, yeah. I had a question about Cobra Law, because I know the name was a placeholder originally, right? So yeah. What were some of the names that you were considering changing it to? Did you even get that far?
I didn't even get that far. I just put it down because we had as I mentioned before, the legal department would have to check names. And we had other things that, would be suggested, and they would say, no, you can't use that name, get rid of it or change it or something. And I figured, if I name it after the single most famous lost civilization in literature, Shangri-La from James Hilton's Lost Horizon, certainly the legal department will flag that down and tell Hasbro, no, you can't use it. And Hasbro fell in love with it. And I begged them all the way through the production. I said, please, just let me change the name to something else. It was a placeholder name. I had no name. I didn't have a chance to develop a name because they insisted it was perfect and they loved it. If I had known they were going to go with it, I would have called it, Festering Monkey Hemorrhoid Island or Graham's Body House. I mean, I tell people, if you have to use a placeholder name, either come up with a placeholder name that at gunpoint you're willing to live with, or something you absolutely cannot use, because otherwise you're going to hate whatever they glom onto. We had, when we were doing as the character was evolving from Cobra Emperor to Serpentor, there was a period of about 1 week where Hasbro told us, well, we've changed the name of the character again, and he's now going to be called King Cobra. And I go, you're going to name him after a malt liquor? I'm not saying a word. I will dearly love to write for a character named after a malt liquor. But, the legal department did their job there, and we're not calling him King Cobra anymore.
Beautiful.
Oh, that's great.
You've given us an hour here, and I can't thank you enough. I wanted to ask you, though, before we let you go today, is there anything you would like to plug out there, any kind of projects you're working on?
I have shifted over to writing novels. I've got like 4 or 5 stockpiled now that the first one has come out, and they're going to be coming out on a regular basis over the next few years. The first one is called Cheeky, and it is based on something that actually happened in the town of Brattleboro, Vermont. Somebody discovered there was a clothing optional law still on the books and took advantage of it in the year 2000. And I just took that idea and I ramped it up to 11. And I like to think it's a pretty fun book. Mike Hill helped me a lot on it. I mean, he gave me a lot of insight on the way that New England towns operate politically. There's this odd governing system in many New England towns. Once a year, they have a town meeting. Everybody in town gets together. They hash out what needs to be done. They hash out the budget. They hash out how they're going to pay for it. And then they hand it over to a city manager to do for the rest of the year. And if they make a mistake, if the budget isn't adequate, or if they pass a law that has unintended consequences, they can't do anything about it until the next year's meeting. And so in my story, somebody discovers this law that had been passed decades earlier, but now there's nothing that can be done about it until next year. And so for the entire summer, there's all kinds of craziness going on. It's currently available on Kindle Vella, which is a subscription-based platform for stories, but it is going to be ported over very soon to ebooks and print-on-demand paperbacks. So keep your eyes out for that.
Yes.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah, so we'll definitely look at that. I think you sent me an advertisement. I'm going to put that in the show notes for everyone. And honestly, for anyone listening, follow Buzz on Facebook or Instagram. He does some of the funniest out of context and captioned old, I guess, old advertisements and old comic strips. Big fan of that. So thank you so
Oh
much
yeah, you got
for
some
what's
your
that?
memes are fire, as the kids say.
As the kids would say. So thank you so much for being here. I appreciate this. This is
Thank
fantastic.
you for having me.
Oh, of course.
Yeah,
this
thanks.
is something that was formative in our young lives. And like I told Mike, he can't quite get behind it, the notion of this. I was like, yeah, all of you guys, wrote our imaginations. You developed it, and we went after what you got your inspiration from, Lovecraft and whatnot. So I appreciate all of that. So I'll let everyone know how to get a hold of you, or how to get a hold of your book, rather. I don't want to blow you up. And which shows are you going to be at here soon? I was talking to Mike about some that are coming up.
I'm not going to be at San Diego this year. Health issues. I'm going to wait until we're absolutely sure the pandemic is over. I was at TransformerCon locally, which is a smaller show, and I really enjoy meeting the fans. I mean, it's always a pleasure to talk to them. I will be at Alpha Omega Con. I believe that's going to be in August, possibly September. Let me check. That is a Christian media convention. I think this is going to be either its sixth or seventh year.
Oh, wow.
And it's if you are interested in Christian media, it is a really good show. They've got a lot of good artists there. Let's see, where are we? Ah, yeah, it will be Saturday, September 7th.
Okay.
And I don't have the address right yet. They'll get that to me, but
No problem.
I'll be there. And I'm mostly local conventions. I'm willing to talk to people about travel and things like that, but I have, sometimes I have family obligations. I'm not able to break free for things. But as I said, I'm not hard to find, and I'm
Right.
always willing to talk.
Very true. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I will let you
Thank
run
you, Evan.
that.
So,
Have a
thank you.
great evening. Have
You too. Thank you.
you. You're
Thank
a
you
good
to
one.
Bob. Yeah.
More Than Mises Guys is performed by Evan Johns and Ed Strickland with Boo of the Excellent Underground.com. Research is also done by Evan Johns, Ed Strickland, and Boo of the Excellent Underground.com. All used images are property of Hasbro, Sunbow, Paramount, and/or Marvel. And without you, none of this would be possible. So thank you so much for being here, and we look forward to you being here every week.